Good morning. Chapter 4 on objectivity. When we started chapter 3, I told you that was my least favorite chapter. I'm happy to say that chapter 4 is my most favorite chapter. My top favorites of my own are 4 and 8. 8 is the one on virtue. But this one, I think, is definitely the best of the first 5 chapters for several reasons. It has the most real, practical cash value. It's the real meat of epistemology. Epistemology is a normative subject. It's supposed to tell you, normative in the broad sense, that it gives you advice. It tells you what to do to improve your thinking. Now, we have to know all the automatic underlying mechanics of concept formation to grasp what concepts really are, so that we can then go on to cash in on that knowledge and figure out principles to guide our thinking. But the purpose was to reach the guiding principles. And that is exactly the substance of this chapter. How should you think? Where would you start to improve your thinking? What does good thinking consist of? What can you as a volitional being do to make your thinking better? And of all the whole basis of foundation of philosophy, this chapter gives you more guidance than any other. So it finally redeems all those foundations that we've been laying. The answer in a word to how to improve your, in two words rather, to how to improve your thinking is remember context and hierarchy and everything that they imply. And of course, therefore, the substance of this chapter consists of reaching and developing those two ideas, the practical substance. Since this is essentially a positive chapter, it is not that technical. I don't think you would have the difficulty with this as with chapter 3, am I correct? This generally should be more easy to follow. And the polemics is very minor. It doesn't exist in the whole first part of this chapter at all. It's purely the proper way to use your consciousness. Although I think that the sequence on polemics at the end is more interesting than the usual polemics, because it gives an insight into the corruption that has dominated Western thought from the beginning. Now, another reason that I like this chapter, beside its practical usability, is that the chapter achieves an important new thing that was not hitherto available in any objectivist literature. I took material that I knew was crucial when I came to do this chapter, but that was in effect miscellaneous, left over, didn't seem to fit. I had a whole bunch of isolated topics that was scattered throughout the objectivist corpus. And I had to figure out, how do these topics interrelate? How can I integrate them into one unit, one sequence of thought, one development? So it was a conceptual process I had to digest. For instance, there's no place in objectivism in the literature that this sequence and integration exists. We have the topic of hierarchy is discussed only in IOE, Introduction to Objectivist Epistemology, under the topic of the hierarchical structure of concepts. Logic is mentioned in a sentence as defined in Galt's speech, but is not brought in any relationship to concept formation in the written material. Objectivity, there's scattered mentions in places that you wouldn't expect. For instance, there's an important treatment of objectivity in Capitalism, the Unknown Ideal. There are mentions of it, of course, in the IOE, but it's sort of all over the place, as and when Ms. Rand felt the need to discuss that in connection with another topic. And of course, context is discussed in relation to definitions, and then is mentioned continuously in the objectivist literature, but nowhere elaborated and discussed as a whole topic. Now, I don't mean that I originated the material in these. I got it all by painstaking questioning of Ms. Wren. But what I did is have to settle now as a formal logical presentation, what is the essential of these four units: objectivity, logic, hierarchy, context. Those are the four big issues of this chapter. And the thing that gave me the direction was the decision that the fundamental concept here was objectivity. That objectivity was the overriding norm, the directive, the basic statement of how consciousness should be related to existence. That, therefore, was the name of the chapter. That was the concept that subsumed the total. And then the question becomes, well, how can you be objective? What should you do in order to achieve this norm? And that led directly to logic as the means of implementing objectivity, the method of objectivity. So the Gall statement, the art of non-contradictory identification, I brought that into relation to objectivity and said that is the way of achieving a certain relation between your consciousness and existence, which we call objectivity. And then, of course, the question becomes, how do you carry out the injunction non-contradictory identification? How can you know that you're being logical? And that led inevitably to context and hierarchy. The need to integrate and the need to reduce your conclusions back to the perceptual level. We'll work the steps of that as we go. But when you see it that way, it's a series of specifications. You must conform to reality. How? By being non-contradictory. How? By integrating and reducing. Oh, that's the overall structure of the chapter. And as a result, I think it all ties together into a perfect methodological unit built on the nature of concept formations, which gives you, at the end, an overview of the proper method of conceptual thought. And from that point of view, the organization was my big contribution in this chapter, and I'm proudest of that than of anything in the first half of the book in terms of a contribution. Of course, the content is entirely Ayn Rand, so far as I'm, you know, can remember her exact wording. She originated all these topics and taught them to me and so on. I'm not saying that. It's just the putting of them together in this sequence in order to make a certain view of how to think. Now, oh, I thank you. I just wanted to clarify why I like this chapter, because I think I really did something here that, as against the last chapter where I just synopsized. Now, I want to give credit here, very important credit, to my lovely wife, Cynthia. Because I would never would have got this chapter this way without something invaluable that she said to me. There was an objectivist conference which shall be nameless some years ago from a competitor in which I had lectured on objectivity as it was then written in the earlier draft of my book. And in that stage of my thinking, I never thought of objectivity except as part of a trichotomy. I never said objective without quickly saying as against intrinsic or subjective. And I brought the three terms into existence in the same paragraph. I gave the definition of each three right off the bat as soon as I opened my mouth. And then every topic that we went through, concepts, logic, whatever it was, right away I'd say there's three positions, A, B, C, and of course this one is right and the other two are wrong. But it was like a trichotomy. It was as though it was identified in my mind as there is no objectivity. There's the objective, intrinsic, subjective as a kind of filter that goes through everything, and then you point yourself on one, but the other two are always there. And I just thought of it. I had never really seen the objective discussed except as part of this trinity. And after I'd given this class, and I was perfectly satisfied with it, Cynthia said, why do you always saddle objectivity with the other two? Why can't you just tell us first what is objectivity and what it leads to and how to be objective and then treat the others just as errors? Now, I had a certain feeling of fear when she said that, because If that were true, that would mean a massive rewrite and rethinking. And nobody wants editing, least of all me. So my automatic reaction was to tell her that's impossible. Because no one could understand what objective was unless you contrasted it with something. And I gave this whole speech about why it couldn't be done. But it was that sort of situation where your mouth is offering an argument, but your mind has been given a blow that it can't really recover from. And that sort of thing percolates in my mind, and after a while I can only evade so long. And in thinking about it, I realized she was absolutely right. It would be as though in metaphysics I had had the trichotomy, existence, God, nothing. And as soon as I said we started with the concept of existence, I would say, of course, there's somebody who believes in two existences and somebody who believes in none. So we have a basic threefold choice going all the way through. And then when I got to identity, I'd say, of course, the supernatural do this and the skeptics do that. That would make hash of metaphysics. It would be as if you can't grasp what is without knowing two bizarre repudiations of it. And of course, I had no tendency to do that in metaphysics. So I was much more at home with the concept of existence than I was with objectivity. Or to give you an even simpler example, as I was thinking about this, it occurred to me, on the most elementary terms, it would be as though you're telling somebody the ethics of getting up in the morning. And you tell them, well, you should have breakfast and brush your teeth and get dressed and so on. And you right away rush in and say, of course, there's two other approaches. There are people who commit suicide as soon as they get up. And there are people who get drunk before they get out of bed. So we have a trichotomy. Normal behavior versus the suicide versus the drunk. Now let's say we get to work. This is what the drunk would do. You'd say, that's fantastic. You know, maybe there is a place to discuss, you know, what suicides and drunks would do, but that is not part of the general positive normative description. Well, after working out what that methodology would have committed me to logically throughout the book, I was finally convinced that her instinct or intuition was completely right, and that it was very distorted in my first presentation that I had to, I actually took scissors and paste, or stapler. I cut out every paragraph or phrase that pertained to the intrinsic and the subjective and just shoved them in a hat or in a box, took what was left and organized it purely logically, and then pasted together what was left on the intrinsic and subjective, which required extensive rewrite because most of what I had said was no longer necessary. Once you had a clear presentation of objectivity, it didn't need to be said. And I condensed it into the present polemical sequence. And I think it's extremely illuminating in a way that was just not possible by the initial approach. So it's another example that polemics is not an inherent part of truth. It's not necessary to present or to grasp the truth. And in fact, it's a pain in the neck if you throw it in the middle of presenting the truth. And I say, I give my full credit for this to my wife because she grasped it somehow at a really invaluable point, and I just take the credit that I swallowed the painful medicine and suffered through it. Now, thank you. One other thing I want to explain, why the present discussion, objectivity, hierarchically must occur at this point, and no earlier and no later. Remember, I want you to keep track of the structure. Well, the simplest way to see why this must be after three is that three deals with what concepts are, and four then deals with how to use them properly. Three tells us these are our tools of cognition. Four tells you this then is the method of using those tools. So logically, you couldn't possibly have a discussion of objectivity, of the way of using concepts, until you first discussed what concepts are. But there is an even deeper reason. It's not just that in general the method of using concepts depends on what concepts are, but the specific concept of objectivity, that particular norm, is itself a derivative of a particular theory of concept formation. Your view of the nature of concepts governs your view of what is objective and whether you can be objective. Concepts, we say in the theory of in concept formation, in that topic, we say concepts are a certain way. They involve a certain relation between existence and consciousness. They're formed by certain volitional processes of our minds reflecting our nature, operating upon the data out there. Well, we say if that is the type of relationship, a process of our consciousness volitionally applied to facts out there, then that is the relationship that must govern all aspects of concept formation and use. That essential relationship, a certain kind of consciousness doing something volitional to the facts of reality. And that becomes then the essence of what is objectivity. Now, this is stated right at the outset on 164 and the top of 165. Concepts as objective, and it says the concept of objective, the bottom of 164, which applies as a norm to all rational cognition, has its roots in the theory of concepts. In other words, that is not a primary objectivity, it's a derivative of a view of concepts. And then the top of 165, objectivity, the very concept, arises because concepts are formed by a specific process and therefore bear a specific kind of relationship to reality. And then the next paragraph states the essence of what we know about the process from concept formation. Concepts don't pertain to consciousness alone or existence alone. They are products of a specific kind of relationship between the two. And the crucial point is that both factors enter essentially. Abstractions going on are products of our faculty of cognition and wouldn't exist without it. But a faculty of cognition is trying to grasp reality and must therefore adhere to reality. Now, this is the basic view of concept which sets the guideline of objectivity. Now, I'll give a formal definition later, but in substance, objectivity says conform to reality. Just as concepts conform to reality, you have to adhere to reality. That's one crucial element. So the dictates of reality are essential, and conformity to reality is essential. But you could not define objectivity as simply conformity to reality, because that could imply, well, you just turn your consciousness loose and let it mold itself around reality. The only way on the conceptual level we can conform to reality is by a certain volitional human process, a certain method of using our mind that has no counterpart on the perceptual level. If we just passively gaze on the conceptual level, we will not conform to reality. And therefore, our consciousness makes a contribution here that has no counterpart on the perceptual level. The perceptual level, you can just look out and gaze, and you see. You don't have to do anything, exert any effort, and use any volition, engage in any conscious activity, follow any method. You just look, and it's as simple as can be. Even a drunk sees. Nothing is required. On the conceptual level, a tremendous inner process and method is required simply to conform to reality. So both of these elements are necessary. And of course, one of these elements, the need to conform to reality, is what the intrinsicists, is what the subjectivists repudiate. And the need for a definite volitional, effortful process that's strictly human is what the intrinsicists repudiate. They try to construe conception as on the model of perception. Just the eye of the mind, so to speak, looks out and grasps conceptual truth the same way the eye of the body looks out and grasps perceptual truth. And of course, objectivism rejects that completely. So if you hold a different theory of concepts than objectivism, if you hold the intrinsic or subjective theory, you will have an entirely different view of how the mind should function, and you will end up attacking objectivity. If concepts are a passive taking in of a revelation from beyond, or if concepts are simply an invention, then objectivity as a norm is simply out. It's pointless and impossible, and you're restricted to either be passive or go by whim. So it's obvious at the outset that the whole discussion of objectivity would be impossible except in the context of a theory of concepts. Now, obviously, this discussion of objectivity also presupposes the earlier chapters. You could only have objectivity within the context of a volitional consciousness. It presupposes logically the grasp of free will, because the essence of objectivity in its very definition is a volitional process. And of course, the essence of objectivity from another aspect is taking your material back to what given. What is the essence of reduction? Go back to the perceptual data. So you couldn't even begin to discuss objectivity until you have first established sensory data. In other words, before you could discuss objectivity, you need to know that you have the choice to think or not, and that you can trust what you perceive. And then, taking it all the way back, think about what? Perceive what? Reality. That's chapter one. So all of that earlier material is logically required. Now, just to go in the other direction for a minute, why couldn't I cover the material in five on reason before we discussed objectivity on four? What would you say to that? Why couldn't I go at this point into reason versus emotion and the arbitrary, etc., certainty, all the topics discussed in five, right here after concept formation? Yes. Exactly. You do not know what reason is until you know the method by which it operates. Reason, there's three things you have to know first before you can reach reason. Reason starts somewhere, sensory data, holds its knowledge in a certain form, conceptual, and acquires its conclusions, uses its concepts by a certain method, which is logic, which itself is the means of objectivity. So to grasp what reason is before you can even get into reason versus emotion and emotionalism and so on, you have to know the method that reason uses. Now, the only thing we said about reason so far in passing in the very first chapter was reason is the faculty that's always oriented to reality. But that is so generalized that Plato, Kant, everybody says they're oriented to reality somehow or other. What we have to do now is give content to a reality-oriented method. Be specific. What does it mean to conform to reality so that reason is not an empty or floating abstraction? How does reason work? What is its proper method? After we grasp that, then reason is just, as a concept, you just put together two, three, and four. Percepts, concepts, and logic, and objectivity, and the result is that's the faculty of reason. And then there's no longer any logical problem. So that is the reason why this has to be placed exactly where it is, and why I think this is the crucial chapter. Five is just a summarizing and cashing in of obvious consequences. But this is the heart, really, of the subject. Now, looking briefly at some of these subjects just from an overview point of view, we start, therefore, by grasping in concepts as objective the essential relation between concepts and reality as far as we're concerned with it here. And this is stated on the bottom of 166 and the top of 167. I just call to your attention there, concepts are condensations, formed in accordance with a human method. You see the bottom paragraph of 166. Now, I say the method is human, and I don't mean that just in the sense that human beings use it or that they have to use it. I mean that in a very specific sense. It's human, our method of forming concepts, because it expresses man's distinctive form of consciousness. That is, I'm not here stating whether there could be other forms of consciousness which are beyond the perceptual but which don't involve concepts. I don't know. I'm not dogmatizing. But what I'm saying is this. It's not in the nature of reality as such. And it's not. It's in the specific, as I put it here, nature and cognitive needs of man's mind. That's the source of concepts. What do I mean by nature there? I mean the fact that our only way of integrating is through commensurability, through relating back to the same unit of measurement. Now that's a fact about man. It's a fact about the objects that when you omit the measurements, what's left can be integrated. It's the same. It's not arbitrary. But nevertheless, it's a fact about the human mind, not about reality, that the way we put things together is through commensurability, through measurement omission. And therefore, that is something on the conceptual level which has no parallel on the perceptual level. There's nothing about our consciousness as such that creates table. The form of perceiving is dictated by our physical senses, but the object is simply out there. But it is our actual consciousness that creates tablehood or tableness, the abstraction, because it's that is simply our way, by the nature of our consciousness, of being able to put a whole bunch of things together via relation to a unit. And therefore, the concept is more distinctively human, in quotes, than the percept. It arises, I say, from the nature. And what do I mean by cognitive needs? The crow epistemology, the reason we have to omit measurements is the need for unit reduction. And that, again, is a need of our consciousness. Reality does not say you have to reduce units. Reality, the units just simply, the existence just simply exists there. So the very processing of the data of reality from existent to unit, and then the reduction, the need to continuously reduce units, all of that is something we contribute from our consciousness. And in that sense, inherent in the nature of a concept is a tremendous contribution from the nature of the human mind. However, having said that, we hasten to say in the next sentence, at the same time, the method has to conform to facts, to reality. Otherwise, it would be irrelevant to cognition. So right away, then, there are two big errors you can make on the face of it. Not that I want to be polemical here, but I can't resist without mentioning it. Man cannot project the products of his method outward as though they're part of reality apart from him. The way who does, the intrinsicist. But nor can he detach them from reality either and say, well, it's just the way my consciousness operates, which is what the subjectivists do. We have here a special kind of status, reality as processed, and as processed in a unique way deriving from our consciousness, as processed by our volitional human consciousness. And this sets up the essence of the idea of objectivity. This is the pattern in right in concept formation that then we're simply going to say this same principle has to apply to all knowledge, all cognition subsequent to this. Now on that foundation we can jump over this elaboration to page 173 within the section now, objectivity as volitional adherence to reality by the method of logic. Now we're going to actually define objectivity, and all we're really doing is putting into a statement the essence of the proper relationship that we grasp from concept formation. But to build up to it, we start on page 173 by pointing out the need of a method of cognition. In other words, deliberately identify rules or processes that we have to go through if the product is to be cognition. That's the first step in grasping objectivity, is to grasp the need of a method, as opposed to doing whatever occurs to you, expecting it to happen automatically, functioning at random. You need to know exactly what rules are you going to follow, what tests are you going to subject your conclusion to in order to qualify it as knowledge. And I think it's a good formulation on the top of 173 there, about five lines down. We have to be able to achieve by deliberate policy what is not guaranteed to us automatically, to remain in contact with the realm of reality. We can do it, but we don't do it automatically. So if we're to do it and know that we're doing it, we've got to have a defined method that will tell us, follow this method and you're okay. Now, the very fact of needing a method, let me point out right here before we go any further, is unique to objectivism and to those aspects of Aristotle where he got that far. The great majority of philosophers, for all their discussion of epistemology, have never entirely grasped this essential point of man's need of a method of cognition. Now, the religious axis tends to believe that on crucial matters, we don't need a method. We can't be wrong if what? We simply wait and let God speak, because he's infallible. Since God is infallible, if we turn ourselves over to him, when the revelation comes, it will be blindingly absolute. There'll be no possible doubt. And therefore, the idea of a method, the only method they give you is how to get to the state of total passivity. For instance, go to the desert and mortify the flesh and drink laundry water and so on and so on. At a certain point, you've effaced your whole existence so thoroughly that you're just a vessel, an emptiness waiting to be filled by the divine. Now, I don't call it a method. That is, it's not a method of cognition. It's a method of getting to the point where you don't need cognition, in their own statement. So those philosophers, the whole religious axis, does not grasp the need of a method. Nor, on the other hand, do the skeptics from the other axis. They say, well, we're not automatically right, so how can you ever trust your conclusions? How do you know you didn't make a mistake? Therefore, they say, we really can't ever know we're right. So one side said, you can't be wrong, so you don't need a method, at least in crucial things. The other side says, you can't be right. Even if you had a method, how do you know the method isn't wrong, you see? So therefore, they simply throw out the possibility. But the objectivist distinctive answer is in the last statement there. Man is, of that paragraph 173, man is not automatically right, and for this very reason, he must define a method that will enable a fallible being to reach the truth. And then the bottom paragraph states the essence of the point. For a volitional conceptual consciousness, a method of knowing reality is both necessary and possible. And that, of course, is what epistemology is all about. Now, we are able to state, in essence, what is objectivity? What is objectivity? Which is the, it really describes the proper relation between existence and consciousness. And I give the formulation as briefly as I can on 174. As I say, it's my own words, but it is Ayn Rand's idea. Second paragraph, to be objective in one's conceptual activities. I put in one's conceptual activities because there's a lot of derivative uses. You know, if you go up to a stranger and say something inappropriate, we can accuse you of being non-objective. So there are many derivative uses, but I'm speaking in the primary sense. And I say, of course, conceptual activities because it doesn't apply on the perceptual level. To be objective is volitionally to adhere to reality. The word volition is in there because this is a norm. This applies only where there's choice. We've already covered that. Could I stop there? No, because if I just said adhere to reality, that leaves wide open. Well, but how do you adhere to reality? Is it just a revelation or what? No, by following certain rules of method. by following certain rules of method. I've already explained why we need a method. Could I stop there? Could I just say, well, to be objective is volitionally adhere to reality by following a certain kind of method? Well, I could, but I want to bend over backwards to stress that we know at the outset two things about the method. What are the two things we know about the method just from the nature of concept formation? Even if we don't yet know the method, we know two things about it. Well, obviously, it has to be itself based on facts, right? If the method is pulled out of a hat like tea leaves, there's no reason in the world why this method is going to enable us to adhere to reality. So if our goal is to adhere to reality by following a method, the method itself must come from reality. We must be able to take whatever our method is and show that it rests on the actual nature of reality itself. So this is not a redundancy that I use reality and facts in the same sentence, because I'm trying to show the way to adhere to reality is a certain method. But that method itself must be based on reality, based on facts. But is that enough? No, because it's not only based on facts. And if you say that, it will suggest that, well, just gaze out and you will find some method dictated by reality itself, apart from anything about your consciousness. And of course, the crucial point is consciousness has identity. And our conceptual consciousness has a very unique identity. And consequently, the method that we use has to not only reflect reality, but must also reflect the specific nature of our form of cognition. It's not that we're simply a mirror looking out. And therefore, the method that we finally find that will enable us to adhere to reality, we have to say two things about this method. We have to show two things. It's dependent on our consciousness, and it's adapted and conformed and derives from the nature of our consciousness, not just reality. But also, it's based on the nature of reality. And if you can find a method like that, and then show that adherence to it must mean the conclusion corresponds to reality, you're all set, you've reached objectivity. You see, the whole thing is simply an application now of what we learned under concept formation turned into a principle now to guide all of our conceptual activities. And that, I'm sorry to say, is the briefest that I could get all that in that sentence. The definition has got to be brief by its nature since it's a condensation. But I just couldn't get it any shorter than that. But I hope you see why every term in that is essential. I have a feeling if Ayn Rand wrote it, she'd write it in half the length and get the same number of points in, but that's the best I can do after 6 years of trying. So I don't want to be Lord Acton and die while I'm still editing. So I've got to go with what is which is avowedly too long, but I just can't squeeze anything more out of it. Now, that is the substance of how you get to objectivity. Now then the question becomes, what is this method? What is the method that will be based on facts appropriate to our form of cognition and which, if we follow, will guarantee that we're adhering to reality? Now it's at that point, of course, that the genius involved was Aristotle. That is why Aristotle is really the father of objectivity. Although he didn't have the full concept because he didn't have a fully appropriate theory of concepts, he couldn't have a full theory of objectivity. But his theory of concepts was good enough so that he steered clear of the supernatural and the subjectivist version. He knew enough to stay miles away from Plato and Protagoras, the ancient sophist. And therefore his theory of concepts was commonsensical enough that he was the first in history to grasp the need of a method rather than a revelation or the futility of skepticism. That's thanks to his theory of concepts, defective as it is. And of course, what he called it is logic, and as Ayn Rand defines it, the art of non-contradictory identification. So she agrees with Aristotle on the nature of logic. She's not original in that topic, but what her contribution here is to identify the need of logic more fundamentally than Aristotle could. He couldn't really give an explanation all the way down why logic was necessary, because his theory of concepts had a definite intrinsicist element. It had an element of just being reduced to passive gazing. And consequently, it's his better side led him to logic, but his more Platonic element made it impossible to really explain the need of logic all the way down to the very nature of human consciousness. Nevertheless, without him, of course, neither any of us nor Ayn Rand nor anything else would have been possible. So it is positively immoral to ever criticize Aristotle, because it's like saying somebody gave you $1 trillion, but he didn't also tie your shoelaces. I mean, you know, it's the height of depravity, so I don't mean to sit up here knowing full well that Aristotle made the entire civilization possible and say, you know, he didn't do enough. You couldn't even do as much in one lifetime as he did, let alone anything more. And that doesn't alter the fact, though, that with all due respect to him and admiration, there were certain deficiencies that simply by the nature of things were impossible for one man to come into existence with omniscience from a void. And this is one of the weak links in his chain. Now, on 179, I'm passing over right now the nature of logic. I cover that in the text, but we just want an overview here. On 179, I show that logic does in fact fulfill the two requirements. It's a method based on, appropriate to human consciousness. It's made necessary by human consciousness first. So it's a human method. And I give that in the paragraph, the second last on 179. If man knew everything about reality in a single insight, logic would be needless. If we reached conceptual conclusions, the way we do perceptual information, just a self-contained, disconnected self-evidency. That's the way intrinsicists think of as the conceptual level too. Just you open your eye and you see and that's it. Then there would be no need for logic. No need. You just have a series of revelations. That's it. But it's because this is not the way we are. Because we follow a certain order, we build conclusions on others. How do we know that? That's the nature of a conceptual consciousness. How do we know that? From the very nature of concept formation. We're continuously condensing units and then more units given the preceding and so on. Well, if that's the case, if we're going from step to step, we need to know, how do we get from step to step? How do we know wherever there's a choice that we've made the right decision? What will guide us in going from step to step? That's why we need logic. So the very need of logic is human. It's not metaphysical. But does that mean that logic is arbitrary or subjective? No, because the essence of logic is identify without contradiction. Integrate your conclusion without contradiction into the rest. And what is the mandate of reality underlying that? What is the fact of reality that gives rise to the need to eschew contradictions? Law of identity. Law of identity. The law of contradiction is simply the application of the law of identity to cognition, to the guidance of a thought process. And therefore, logic is the method by which a human discursive, step-by-step consciousness can ensure conformity to the basic law of reality and therefore reality. That's what it comes down to. And therefore, it qualifies as the method of adhering to reality volitionally. And it is that method because it's based on reality as required to be understood by our consciousness. Now then, that is basically as far as Aristotle went. And of course, he worked out in great detail all the different forms of deductive logic. He had very little to say about inductive logic. Nobody has had very much to say about that ever since. But his achievement was, of course, enormous, but You can only go so far with the broad injunction to be consistent. Don't contradict yourself. And then the question becomes, how do you know when you are contradicting yourself, when you are consistent? And in order to answer those questions fully, that's where we need the two issues that Ayn Rand uniquely brings in, both dependent on her theory of concepts, and that is context and hierarchy. If you just tell a person, don't contradict yourself, go, okay, goodbye and good luck. Well, you know, it's just a question of what you could do with that information. How much does he have to take into account? If you just looks at two premises and the conclusion follows in a vacuum, that little premise, conclusion, and there's no contradiction, does that mean it's non-contradictory identification, therefore it's logical, therefore it's true, and therefore this is objective? That is the way people treat it today, but they know enough to know it's not objective, so they say nobody can be objective. Logic is just a little game of deriving conclusions from premises, and has nothing to do with reality. If logic is to be the way of conforming to reality, then a conclusion can't be judged as consistent or contradictory simply by reference to a few little premises plucked out of context. What do you have to do? You have to find a way of being non-contradictory throughout the total sum of knowledge. And that brings us to the issue of all of knowledge is interrelated. Every item of knowledge is related to the rest. In a way, the total of knowledge is the context for any item of knowledge. And therefore, knowledge is a sum, and you can't claim something as non-contradictory until you've related it to the total sum. And that is a revolution. That is distinctively Ayn Rand. And when we elaborate that, you see that that is like a detail of how to be logical, but a life and death detail, because without it, you can't apply the formula non-contradictory identification. You don't know what is consistent. Now, the other crucial thing is hierarchy. Non-contradictory identification. Well, okay, that means we're going to have premises and our conclusion mustn't contradict it. Can we take any old premises and just show that we don't see any contradiction between this conclusion and the, suppose we try to integrate, we don't see any contradiction between a certain conclusion and anything else we can think of. Does that make it logical? No, we're trying to conform to reality. Are our premises based on reality, is the question. We have to take the conclusion back to reality. That process is called proof. The step-by-step process of reduction, and of course the need of that derives from the fact that knowledge is hierarchical. So context and hierarchy, those two contain the essence of what being logical consists of. And that's basically what the chapter, the meat of the chapter is. Now I'm going to leave hierarchy entirely for tomorrow. But let's say some words in an overview way about the need of context. We're focusing on it now from the point of view of the need, expression of the nature of logic. Let's turn to page 186 at this stage. Well, here I really state what is the answer to what I said. How is the very bottom paragraph? How is a man to know whether he's contradicting himself? And then on the top of 187, the only way is if he integrates a new idea. Consciousness, conceptual consciousness, is an integrating mechanism. It demands the integration of all its contents. Well, on this level, of course, the conceptual level, it doesn't integrate automatically. So then I give the next paragraph, one step at a time, a man must relate a new item to his previous ideas. If he finds a contradiction anywhere, he must eliminate it. And Ayn Rand includes that under the formula non-contradictory identification. Then the key point is the bottom here. One is not using logic if one seeks consistency only among whatever random ideas one happens to recall on the spur of the moment. Blindness, not seeing one's other views or knowing about one's contradictions, is not the means of being logical. So knowledge, logic requires an understanding of the fact that knowledge is a unity, not a realm of separate atoms. And then the key sentence at the top of 88, only if one keeps context can logic be the method of adhering to reality. Otherwise, it's merely a game or a rationalist deduction and avoid. That's the only way that logic becomes a means of obtaining objectivity, if you retain the full context. Now, I might just tell you a conversation I had with Ayn Rand that I wanted to put in here, but I couldn't get it in a form that didn't raise more questions than an answer. But it's illuminating to me, so I'm going to add it in here. I had a lot of trouble with the need of integration in early days. You know that Ayn Rand was a master of integration. In fact, one of the things that first attracted me to her philosophy was her ability to see connections between the most incredibly diverse things. Liberals and conservatives and sex and economics, and you know, she could bring together, weld together and get a unity out of the most enormous diversities. But I one day was questioning, well, this was decades ago, and I put this question to her. Why can't I give a proof of a certain conclusion? What I can't remember what it was, but X, some conclusion. And I give an airtight proof, step by step, going back, let us say, to sensory data. And you don't see, there's nothing wrong with the proof, you agree with me and so on. Why can't I say, I hereby detach this conclusion from all the rest that I will ever learn. I'm not going to, I mean, I did this to try to isolate something, you see, from her. I'm never again going to consider this conclusion in relation to anything that is newly discovered. I'm not going to consider any future implications. I'm not going to consider the implications of anything new on it. This is now hereafter an isolated absolute. But I know it's true still. I mean, no matter what comes in any other field or in any other stage of knowledge, I'm still holding on to this conclusion and the links that took it back to sensory data. So why can't I do that? In other words, why, if my conclusion is reliable and is an absolute, can't I chop off the rest of the context and just cling to it forever? Not that it would be, you know, a very practical idea, but just theoretically. Why is, this was I was trying to elicit from her, why integration is of the essence. And why, if you don't integrate a perfectly valid conclusion to everything in every field, including the new that hasn't yet been discovered, when you discover it, you wipe out even the perfectly good from the old context. And her answer, we had a long, long discussion, but her answer consisted of saying that the essence of cognition is integration. If relevant information, now not, you don't take every new piece of information and check it against everything you hold, that's obviously impossible. But if you have any reason to believe that there is some relevant new fact in any area that bear on or relate to one of your conclusions, but you say to hell with it, I'm satisfied with what I got, I'm arrested at this stage. Then she said, your knowledge is no longer a whole. You are now, therefore, outside the method of logic. You've cut yourself off from the man's means of knowing that he conforms to reality. Perhaps I give you this as an analogy. What would be wrong with a living being saying, now this is an analogy, but nevertheless it's a valid one here, I've breathed enough. Or I've eaten enough, I've been doing it for years, and I'm going to stay where I am right now. You realize that inherent in this entity is a continuous process. And if it cuts off the process, that's death. It's also true that the living entity can't be concerned only with any one attribute apart from the total. It can't say, well, I'll nourish the legs and to hell with the heart or the lungs. It's got to keep the total going because every part is interconnected. Now, knowledge in that sense is like a living entity in both regards. The process which sustains any item of cognition has to be continuous, a continuous process of welding together the whole. It's an exact parallel to, and I don't think it's just a parallel because after all, this is an aspect of a living entity. So it's not, and consciousness is a living organ, a living attribute, a vital organ. And therefore, I don't think it's an accident that what's true of biological processes in general is true of a conceptual consciousness. It must continuously be active, and it must continuously keep its parts interrelated the way the parts of a living organism are. Now, you may find, when you look at a new piece of information, you have to amend a definition, expand it, change it. You may have to put a qualification in one of your generalizations that you didn't previously know. You may see a new aspect. Say, oh, this throws light on my earlier point. It would be better to formulate it this way rather than that way. Now I see a distinction that I didn't get before. Now, that and many more are the types of things you get from new knowledge that clarify and make more precise old knowledge. The new information does not, I underscore, does not invalidate your old formulations if you continuously integrate the new information. You keep the thing a single whole at every stage. But if you don't integrate, then the new information does. If you don't check what is the connection between what I've known up to now and the new data that's available to me, then you are literally in the position you do not know whether you're holding contradictions or not, whether you need some change of what you've said or not, whether the new item is consistent with your previous understanding or not, whether you need amendments, revisions, a different perspective or not. Let me put it to you this way. You know how skeptics have what they call the problem of error. The problem, how do you know you didn't make a mistake? After all, we're fallible. Now, we always say that's an invalid question. They have to have a basis to hypothesize error. But it's an invalid question only on the premise that we are continuously integrating. If we cut off the process of integration in the way I was hypothesizing to Ms. Rand and just cling to something, then we have no answer to the skeptics who say, how do you know you didn't commit an error? Man is capable of error, and we have detached ourselves from the process of discovering it. Now, if you integrate, the simple answer to the skeptic is, everything I know answers you. The totality of my knowledge stands behind this answer, so I know it isn't wrong. I've integrated it to everything. It has the weight of the sum of cognition. But once you disintegrate it, we have no answer to, how do we know we didn't make a mistake? How do we know what its status is anymore? It simply becomes an isolated, in effect, a memory that once, long ago, we saw its relation to reality, but no more. The way we know we never committed an error is the fact that we are always looking at everything. In that context, the skeptic who says, how do you know, is utterly baseless. But in the context of a consciousness which ceases integrating, there is no answer to how do you know you didn't miss something. You're not even looking. So how can you know? You're completely cut off. So that question I posed to Ms. Rand was extremely illuminating to me. She combined the absolute certainty of one school of philosophy, you know, the rationalists who say everything is an absolute, with the, quote, openness and interest in new discoveries that is always associated with the empiricists. But the dichotomy in philosophy, the rationalists believe in certainty at the price of saying to hell with reality. We have our absolutes and we don't want to learn anymore. And the empiricists are open-minded, in quotes, and they want to grasp everything new, but they are then turned skeptic and say, you see, we can never, how can we know whether what we have is an absolute? Who knows if we're going to learn tomorrow? Now, what Ayn Rand uniquely combined was the idea, it's 100% absolute at every stage precisely because we're open to and integrate everything at every stage. You see, and that is a unique perspective, and the key to it is the idea that cognition is integration, of which, of course, that's simply the expression on the broad conscious level of what the essence of our conceptual faculty is. It's a faculty of putting together units into a super unit. It's an integrating faculty. Now, I found this very helpful when she explained it to me, because I always thought of integration as kind of a duty over and above thinking, you know, somehow you have to connect it to other things. But I figured I've got a proof, particularly when I was polemically oriented, I got a proof that I can beat anybody over the head with. I didn't have much of a feeling for the need of integration, but this finally knocked it into my head, so I'm hoping that some of you find this helpful. So, I'm not going to, as I say, discuss hierarchy today, but we could just bring it in by way of summary. We want to be non-contradictory in our identifications. Since all knowledge is relational, then we have to do the relating, that is, integrate it into a total. Since all knowledge is built on the senses, then we have to bring it all back to the senses. We have to reduce it. When we do that, then we have been logical, and then we can say our consciousness is a grasp of existence by a certain method. And that is objectivity. Now you see at the very end of the chapter, I'm cutting out all the content here, but just to get to the page 226 and 7, this I think names the really crucial and revolutionary character of Ayn Rand's achievement in this regard. The last part, starting at the bottom of 226. She is the first thinker to identify explicitly the fact that logic, including the recognition of context and hierarchy, is the method of achieving objectivity. And of course, the underscored part is the crucial thing, because she did not invent logic nor the concept of objective. And this knowledge is what was necessary to convert objectivity from the status of elusive ideal to that of normal actuality, because this is what enables us not only to conform to reality, but to do it methodically, to know that we're doing it, and thereby to be in control of the process of cognition. And as I say, if there are landmark discoveries, this is one of them. As you see, it's a derivation of her theory of concepts. And if you watch how people use the word logic, you will see how unusual this is. The last two things that people would think of when they talk about being logical is, one, relating a conclusion to all the other things you know on other subjects. They would never dream of that. Logic is just deriving it from some other ideas. A little chess game where you say this, therefore this, and therefore this. Anybody can prove anything, you know. And the other thing is relating a conclusion to what you see, hear, taste, touch, and smell. Their idea is, you know, philosophers make this explicit, there's perception and then there's logic. And logic is its own little world of constructs. Well, of course, if that's your idea of logic, it's no wonder that it's in complete disrepute. And that's why everybody goes around saying objectivity is unattainable, there's only your subjectivity versus my subjectivity, and so on. It's because the essence of logic is not clear, because the nature of concepts which give rise to logic is not clear. So I think this is a spectacular achievement on her part, and I do think it's made clear in substance in this chapter. Let us take our 5-minute break now. I'm going to start by taking questions on the first section. I'd like to theoretically get through the first three sections in order today, and then we'll do the last half tomorrow. concepts as objective, because this is pretty straightforward. So let's give 15 minutes only to this. Who has questions on this first sequence? It's basically the nature of concepts from the aspect of objectivity, and then how it applies to definitions, when you should and shouldn't form concepts, the issue of options. I have questions. John.
Before I ask my question, if I could make an observation having to do with knowledge as contextual, I think it's fascinating to see how all of the courses that are being given here in various ways are overlapping with one another, which I'm sure is a dramatic demonstration of that point.
Yeah, can I just say a word on that before you go on? Because President Ridbath pointed this out to me, that one class illuminates another class, and that students have had this experience many times. Something said in somebody else's course ties into something in another course, and they suddenly get a higher synthesis, a higher clarification. That is integration at work. When he pointed that out to me, I wanted him to make that point. That is an example also of the spiral theory, which is an application of integration, which is too technical for this book. But it was Ayn Rand's idea that you don't just learn something once and for all. You learn it, you go on to something new, then you come back and see the connection to what you already knew, and then you go on and come back and go on and come back in the form of a spiral. And if you are active, you should be continuously coming back to material that you knew perfectly well and say words to the effect of, and now I really see it. Now it's really clear. And of course, it was clear before, but it means you're integrating it on a broader scale, and that is an example of integration at work. So the whole conference ideally should be massive. Everything should feed into everything else, which is the opposite of what today's modern curricula are. You know, where one professor says, don't bother me with the other class. I don't know anything about his subject or what he's saying, and just follow this particular chain. And if it contradicts, what can you do? Now, you had something you wanted to ask. Yeah.
I wanted to ask if you could clarify the use of the, on page 168,
yeah,
at the very top, the reference to the term essential is epistemological.
Right.
Could you clarify that in connection with the idea that when we talk about an essential characteristic of something as that which makes it what it is, which seems to carry metaphysical connotations,
no,
metaphysical causality.
Yeah, no, that's not right. I wouldn't put it that way. The question is, when we say that the essential is that which makes a thing what it is, doesn't that mean we're talking metaphysics? It's this attribute is what makes this entity. No. The word make there, I elaborated when I used it earlier. You couldn't say the essential characteristics make a man a man, but the non-essential don't. Every aspect of man makes him human. Nor would he be a human being if he lacked any of those attributes. It's obvious, for instance, if he didn't have lungs, if he didn't have a heart, if he didn't have legs, etc. He would not be a human being, although those things are not, quote, essential. Now, in another sense, metaphysically, you could say everything is essential, but then essential adds nothing. It means it's an aspect of the identity. When we say it makes the thing, we're speaking from the point of view of concept formation. We're saying it makes the classification. It makes it subsumable in this concept rather than that one. It makes it, it enables us to hold everything. It's the characteristic that condenses the content and enables us to hold it. Now, it's not detached from reality. It has to be a fact about the concretes, that these things distinguish them from the other things we know. And it has to be a metaphysical fact, if we're using the term fundamental, that certain facts are the cause of other facts, which are the effect. Cause and effect we don't invent, obviously. Distinctions we don't invent, obviously. But the use of distinctions, similarities, and causality to define such a thing as the essential only comes up because of a need of concept formation. Without us, there would be similarities, differences, and causality, but there would be no essences. You get that?
Yes.
Okay, anything further on this first sequence? Yes. The concept of what?
Objective. Oh. In Ms. Graham's own thinking, was it an idea that she understood fully explicitly when she wrote that book, or was it?
Oh, yes, yes. The concept of objective in Ayn Rand's thinking, could I elaborate on its development? I don't know of any development. She knew it from the time I met her in 1951. When she was already, I met her the day she started part three. Of Atlas Shrugged, and she had it then, so I don't know where it goes back to. It must go back to her thinking, I'm hypothesizing, in the 40s, which is when she first reached her theory of concept formation. Now, I'm sure that contextually, in a broad sense, she didn't invent objectivity, the concept. That, of course, goes way back. It means orientation to the object as against to the subject. But she did some crucial things with regard to that, telling us how to orient ourselves to the object. And she was the one who said that there is more than one way of ignoring objectivity. She coined the term intrinsicism, you see. So she was the one that said there are two ways of missing objectivity, the method of the subjectivist and the method of the intrinsicist. So she did monumental things, but all of that, I would take it, was implicit in her thinking when she grasped the theory of concept. It was before my time, anyway. Yes?
Back to the point of sexualism being metaphysical or metaphysical.
Yes.
Don't we sometimes treat some sexuals as metaphysical? Like a surgeon who would cut away a leg or an appendix or something because it is a non-essential.
Yeah. Now you're switching categories here. You say a surgeon can cut away a leg because it's a non-essential. That is completely invalid reasoning, unless you're equivocating. A surgeon couldn't say to himself, leg isn't mentioned in the definition, therefore I can cut it out. Because by that same token, head isn't mentioned in the definition either. So you can cut it off. Surgeons do not amputate according to what's in the definition. So when you say, because a leg is non-essential, you are changing. It's not that it's non-essential to being a man, it's non-essential to remaining alive in some form. Now the word essential, you know, can in many contexts be used as equivalent to indispensable, mandatory, non-optional, you've gotta have it. You know, there's three essentials to go to college, one of which is to pay tuition. That is not the use that we're talking about here. Here we're using essential as it relates to the topic of concepts and definitions. The essence of a group, the essence of a class, what makes man, man. And it's in that specialized use that we say the term is epistemological. If you use it in a loose sense to mean merely a prerequisite of something, then of course that has nothing to do with epistemology as such, but then it's just a synonym for many other terms which also exist. Maybe that is linguistically clarified. All right, I'm ready, as I see you are, to go on to the important section, objectivity as volitional adherence to reality by the method of logic. Now, I think I've pretty much pointed out, on 175, I might just few details here. The substance of objectivity is captured there. A conceptual consciousness at the top of 175 must focus on reality by a deliberate resolve. It must look at reality, that's adhering, and then it has to discover and choose to practice the method to implement this resolve. It's not enough to say, yeah, I'm going to stick with reality. It has to find the method and then practice. And that's what objectivity designates as against the two deadly errors. And here we can figure out the errors in logic before we even go to the other theories. Trying to find a shortcut. trying to get around the need of the effort and the work involved. In other words, just look out and hope reality will do the work. That's one, the intrinsicist view. And the only other error is give it up. Say it's hopeless. I can't do it. I'm not going to try to conform to reality. And that amounts to saying I'm going to live only with the subject and deal with the object. That's subjectivism. But if you don't commit those two errors, you do look out and you don't expect reality to do it for you, then you have to perform the process according to a certain method. That is objectivity. So that's why in theory there's only the two ways of going wrong here. And this is what underlies, these two errors are what underlie intrinsicism and subjectivism. Trying to have a shortcut or simply giving up, quitting, futility. And if you'll notice, skeptics are always world weary. They're always suffused with futility. It's hopeless, you can't know, and so on and so on. Now, very important point I want to call to your attention on 178. I've said it, but I want to just point to the actual formulation because I like the example. I think it's a good example. To derive a conclusion from, this is a second sentence of the second paragraph. To derive a conclusion from arbitrary premises is not a process of logic. And then this example, if I say apples are razors and oranges are blades, therefore you can shave with fruit salad, that is not cognition. That is just, as I said, imitation of the form of logic while dropping its essence. And here we always have to remember, when you talk about logic, where it comes. Logic is the method of keeping your consciousness related to existence. It's the means of objectivity. That's what it's for. That's why it's necessary. That's how it arises. Anything, therefore, which begins with, to hell with reality, now let's be logical, is out. That's a self-contradiction on the face of it. Therefore, anybody like modern logicians who say the basic premises of reasoning are arbitrary. Logic is just how to string together and figure out the implications of arbitrary premises has already gutted the whole method of logic. And it's no longer logic. It's just manipulation of words like chess. It has no cognitive status. It has nothing to do with logic. Logic is the means of objectivity. And that being so, the process is applicable only when it's grounded in the perception of reality. So any derivation of a conclusion from premises, the premises themselves must either be perceptual or reducible to the perceptual. And that is really the root as to why we have to engage in reduction. Reduction, as I say later, is the key process here, and proof is simply a form of reduction. We'll discuss that later when we get to hierarchy, but right from the outset, I want you to get in your mind the idea that if something is detached from reality, it thereby disqualifies itself as any relation to logic. Logic is only a method of attaining a certain relation to reality. Now, on 179, the first full paragraph, that is so characteristic of Ayn Rand's approach, that all these crucial necessities of life are not made necessary merely by the existence of other people. They're not social in character. Logic is a, I use the word personal, practical, selfish necessity. It's just like language, which is another thing that everybody says is only social. But you would need it on a desert island, just as you would need logic, and parenthetically, just as you would need morality. All these essentials of human life that the typical theory makes as a social, but the idea that on a desert island you wouldn't need values, thought, concepts, logic, nothing. Somehow you'd be able to function without any of it. All of these things are only because you interact with others is fantastic ignorance. I'm grasping what are you talking about and why does man by his nature require them? So this is a uniquely to Ayn Rand, this grasp that all these norms and all these processes are required by man's nature, not by some arbitrary social decree. All right, now let's take a few minutes for questions on this section. In the yellow, way up in the balcony, here. Loudly. Is the learning of it to what? What is the role of symbolic logic, and how important is it to learn it in order to guard against deceptions? Well, you really mean deductive logic, because that's all that's been essentially symbolized. I do not have a very high regard for its importance or necessity. I don't think the type of fallacies that people substantially commit in life are the sort of fallacies that are identified in symbolic logic. Unequivocally not in the modern approach to symbolic logic, which has nothing to do even with psychotic thought, let alone the normal thought. If you're talking about Bertrand Russell and that, you know, material implication and so on, that's all is simply a fantasy. It would be much more clarifying to your thinking to watch Nightmare on Elm Street than to read that stuff. Now, Aristotle, I think his logic was a crucial step. Not so much, although to some extent, because he named fallacies that we can then watch out for, as he was the first one to give us the concept of validity and to show that certain modes of thinking, the conclusion, did follow and others they did not. And within the limits of the syllogism, he was exhausted. And it was ever since like a model of that there is such a thing as validity and sharply demarcated good from bad thinking. I think that had to be concretized in some such form as he did in order ultimately to reach the idea of a proper method of thinking. And therefore it was as a learning stage indispensable. I don't think, however, that in and of itself those particular fallacies are, you know, urgent to study. I don't think that the way to carry on Aristotle's work is to take every possible combination of statement, wherever you can put an if, an and, a then, a not, etc., and symbolize it all page after page. I think that's completely absurd. So I would say if you want to clarify your thinking, you're much better off to go into epistemology than to symbolic logic. Yes?
I'm wondering why Ayn Rand chose to describe the method of logic as an art as opposed to a science.
Well, logic is an art, a science, and a method. So that depends what perspective you're looking at, the genus. She called it art in God's speech because it's something you do. She was thinking of it as a practice you perform that you have to learn how to do, like the art of shoemaking. But what you have to learn to do is apply a certain method. So you can certainly call logic a method, as she did and as I did. That is a certain sequence of rules that you have to follow in a certain structure in order to, in this case, validate a conclusion. But, and then from another aspect, you can call logic a science in that you can methodically study the laws of logic, the rules of inference. That's what symbolic logic attempts to do. So from that aspect, the study of it is a science. But she was looking at it from the point of view of, you know, an activity that requires a certain skill that you learn to perform, and that then, like the art of shoemaking, the art of teaching, the art of logic. Yes.
Question regarding integration. I was wondering if I could make a comment regarding your comment on symbolic.
Yeah, but you have to do it a lot. Well, you have to know. Choose one or the other because we're getting short. I'd go on to one about integration. I think that's more fruitful.
Yeah, I was wondering, you've been emphasizing integration, and you made the statement that the essence of cognition is integration. I was wondering, isn't differentiation equally important in cognition to integration?
Am I what? Subordinating it?
No, it's different. I mean, you seem to not be emphasizing differentiation.
Oh, I see. Well, that's a good point. By saying that the essence of cognition is integration, am I in effect downplaying differentiation? No, I'm taking it for granted. You can't integrate till you have separate things to put together. But what is the fact that you have to distinguish one thing from another is not distinctive to objectivism. That has been long accepted. In fact, the essence of analysis is to make distinctions between one thing and another. The only people where differentiation would be a fighting word would be a community of out-and-out mystics, you know, who believe that all is one, that distinctions are unreal, that you are really me and I'm the desk and we're all interchangeably one. Now then, if you lived in that kind of world, I guess you'd have to make a big point about the need to focus on differences. But I'm taking for granted that we've reached, you know, the stage of knowledge where, the stage of civilization, where we have to distinguish one thing from another. In fact, the distinction is given us in perception. What is the crucial new thing here is the need when we have conclusions, they're already distinct each time we come to a conclusion. That's inherent in the process, but they're not necessarily connected to your other conclusions. So I'm not slighting differentiation, but I am emphasizing what is a unique responsibility of ours. Yes?
In our politics class, we're identifying the essence of a particular political situation in order to judge it. What is, I'm using essence, and that's what I'm trying to connect to, in essence, in like the gentleman was saying.
How do you relate the essence of a political situation to the essence of a concept? Well, essence is a term that has many derivations from the primary use, which is in connection with concepts. But you can take any situation which has a multiplicity of facets or factors and use a similar type of analysis and call something the essential. As long as you realize this is a derivative use, this is not essential the way a definition is. For instance, I happened to be at the lecture you referred to, I could not talk about the essence of the Mideast crisis as though that meant the same thing literally as the essence of man. The Mideast crisis is a whole combination of facts and wars and hostilities and so on. That is not a concept. But now within that, I can, since I have concepts and definitions, I can make distinctions. I can say certain aspects of this crisis are common to every other crisis, but certain aspects are distinctive. Those aspects, I'll focus on if I'm trying to understand this situation. So that's a parallel. Then I can say, in all the distinctive features, there's one that underlies, that explains the PLO, that explains the Israeli behavior, that explains the West's shameful capitulations and so on. And what underlies it is what the Israelis represent Western civilization as against barbarism. Now there you're going to a fundamental. So you're following the same general method that you follow in concept formation, but you're doing it now to try to explain or understand a whole constellation of facts. You're really in the field there of science and of causal explanation. So it has a parallel, but just don't think that although it's not equivocation, it's not literally the same thing. There's no such concept as the Mideast crisis in 1990. That is a whole complex state of affairs. Okay, but it's worth pointing that out as long as you don't confuse. Yes?
Yeah, the question about identification on page 175.
Yes.
It says, three lines from the bottom, it says, on the perceptual level, we learn only that that an entity is, not what it is.
Right.
Even so, perception is a form of apprehending identity.
Yeah.
To perceive an entity is to perceive it as something. The ability to define that identity in explicit terms is the next stage.
Right.
Isn't there an intermediate perceptual stage of implicit identification? For example, animals know that more than that something exists, they know they can bite certain things or other things might bite them.
Oh, sure. There is... If you broke this down into every stage, but in the sense of what you are saying, you're saying, I'd say perception is a form of apprehending identity on the bottom of 175. I said, in the sense that you grasp that it's something. And then on the next stage is to name it explicitly. You say, isn't there another stage? Well, what do you mean by grasping? It is something. That is not empty. You have to hold that something in perceptual terms. Now, if you're a baby or an animal, you grasp that it is something in the form of, let us say, the visual percept. That is the way you can't name what that percept is. It's not that it's red or square or whatever, but it's something that you perceive. Now, if you've also learned, as you're suggesting, across time that it tastes good, that is part of the percept then. The memory is the sensation, you see, which is built in to the percept. And consequently, you're still on the perceptual level, incorporating your past experience into your present percept. But you're still grasping that it's something, not just abstractly something, it's that thing that you're perceiving with all that your consciousness tells you about it, but it tells you only in sensory form. And then the next stage after that is put it into language, conceptualize. Yes.
On page 176.
Second
paragraph.
Yeah.
You see, to be is to have a nature. That is the law of existence.
Right.
Which thereby defines the function of consciousness.
Right.
How can you say it defines the function? How can it define?
Well, it enables us to define the function of consciousness, but it specifies, it is the guideline to tell us. It is the fact which says, since this is the way things are, therefore this is what we have to do. That was Ayn Rand's crucial line here on page 176. Existence is identity, consciousness is identification. That's from Galt's speech. Existence and identity is identity. That's the law of existence. That's simply the way things are apart from us. But now, consciousness is the faculty of perceiving existence. Well, what must perceiving existence consist of if existence is identity? It must be grasping identity. There's no way to grasp that something is without in some terms grasping what it is, whether perceptually or later conceptually. So I mean it defines the function of consciousness in that if you know that existence is identity, and you simply think of that in conjunction with the faculty of consciousness, that will tell you what must be the function of consciousness. There's nothing else to be aware of in being aware of things except being aware of what they are.
But we already know that it's a faculty.
Oh yeah, it's the faculty of perceiving reality from chapter 1. We're now in chapter 4, so I'm taking for granted that consciousness is the faculty of perceiving that which exists. Oh, you forgot that. Yeah.
No, I don't know. Oh.
Well, it's a tremendously compressed statement on her part, but I think myself that that's a tremendous virtue of this statement. She's got four big capitalized nouns that cover the waterfront. That is a wonderful integration, I think. Who has something more on Ray?
Chapter 3. Concepts, you talk about concepts for a certain time, and then you say, if you want more, go to the introduction.
Yes.
And chapter 4, you talk about logic a little bit, and then you don't put any road signs to go further. Is it the case you're going to have some sort of reference or a future word or what?
Well, where would I tell people to go? No, well, where do you think I should point them to?
Is it the case there is no place to point them to?
Do I know of further discussions of logic from an objectivist viewpoint? No. I don't know where I could point you to. I know a certain objectivist, or one in particular, who's thinking about writing a book on logic, but I can't refer to it till it exists. so I can't give a road sign at this stage, maybe in a later edition. At the very back, yeah. Say again.
What is the status of a conclusion derived from a fact and an arbitrary?
It's out. What is the status of a conclusion derived from the combination of a fact and an arbitrary assertion? Rocks are made by gremlins. There are rocks on Mars. Therefore, they were made by gremlins on Mars. That's a fact. They're rocks. It's an arbitrary assertion. They're made by gremlins. It follows that they're made, that there are gremlins there, but that obviously is fantasy. Any one, you don't do it by proportion. You don't say, well, my premises are half good, so my conclusion is half good. Any departure at any one point wipes out everything thereafter. You have no longer any means to know whether your errors cancel themselves out or not. You've lost your method of cognition, so it may as well be the whole thing is arbitrary. And this is where it's absolutely valid to say the chain is no stronger than its weakest link. If it breaks anywhere, you may as well not do it. Okay. Well, a point does not dictate any curve. A million different curves could go through one point. It's not an arbitrary curve if all you're doing is exercising your fantasy. But if you're putting together scientific data and you have only one point, and you could do it 15 or 20 different ways, and you do it this way and say, there, that's proven, here's the point. Obviously that's, I mean, you don't have to ask me if that's arbitrary. What? Arbitrary means a matter of your sheer whim, and since you've got 360 degrees to go around with that point, that you pick out. Now, if you have a second point, then you have a straight line dictator. But if you have only one point, unless you're engaged in art, if it's supposed to be cognition, it's arbitrary. I think I'm going to switch to the section on context now, which is the beginning of the real practical meat. And I want to call your attention to somebody's suggesting I just ignore the face that I make here, right? Get my voice back. One more. On 182 and 183, I state the basis of the whole discussion of context in an underscored sentence. I use underscoring very infrequently, so if I use it, I obviously think it's important. Human knowledge on every level, meaning there perceptual as well, is relational. It's an organization of elements, each relevant to and bearing on the other. As against the view that knowledge is a series of isolated propositions or subject matters, any one of which can exist apart from the rest. That is the view that underlies the whole need of integration, the whole issue of context. And in itself, the relational nature of knowledge has two roots, metaphysical and epistemological. Now, the principle of knowledge as hierarchical is purely epistemological, but the principle of knowledge as contextual has a metaphysical and an epistemological root. That is something about reality and something about our consciousness. And those two are given on 183. Metaphysically, the fact that everything in reality is interconnected. And therefore, it's a whole. And if knowledge seeks to grasp reality, it too must be a whole. It must be completely interconnected to reflect the whole, which is the universe. And then the other aspect, the nature of consciousness. The nature of consciousness as such is the discovery of relationships. Both differentiation and integration is the grasp of a relationship. Difference is this is different from that. Integration is this belongs with this. I'm going to relate them, put them together. But the grasping of relationship is the essence of consciousness. And therefore, a consciousness is a relating mechanism. So when you say knowledge is relational, you're merely applying to the product the central attribute of the faculty of cognition. Bringing into connection, that's what consciousness is. And of course it's not arbitrary, because that is also the way the universe is. That's the metaphysical side. But I want to point out to you, both of these are central. On the top of 84, the idea that consciousness is relational, you don't have to know that on the perceptual level, because you're automatically given the necessary relations. But on the conceptual level, the fact that knowledge is relational does mean you have to do something. You have to do the relating deliberately. And so the whole of epistemology really consists of saying, since knowledge is a certain sort of thing, this is what you have to do. Knowledge is relational, then relate. Knowledge rests on a context, then don't drop it. Knowledge is built in a hierarchical structure, then obey it, etc. All of it, and the whole structure of the argument is, knowledge is a certain way, therefore this is what you should do. And why is knowledge a certain way? Ultimately, because consciousness is a certain way, trying to grasp existence of a certain kind. So we go back to the axiom. Now, looking at context uniquely here, this paragraph, the second paragraph, that is my own definition of context. The sum of cognitive elements conditioning an item of knowledge. The item might be a concept, a proposition, a theory, a whole field. The sum. Everything else you know that is relevant to, that conditions that item. And of course, ultimately, the context of any given item is the totality. But the crucial point I want to call out to you here is the sentence, this sum, context, is what sets the item's relationship to reality, and thus the item's meaning and proper use. Context has a crucial function. Precisely because our knowledge is related, each item, to all the rest, without all the rest, we are helpless with any given item by itself. We have no way to prove it, to interpret it, to apply it, because we can only do that by seeing it in relation to the whole. And the simplest example is this. I bring you into a lecture. I say, this guy is speaking English. Listen. The speaker stands up and he says, all men are equal. Thank you. And sits down. And you go out of the room now. I say, what'd you think of his viewpoint? Well, I don't know. Well, why not? It's a perfectly clear statement, subject and a predicate. You know all the words. You say, well, what is it that you don't know? Where is he coming from? What kind of premises is he taking for granted? How would he apply that? Is he talking in terms of their height? Is he saying they're equal in rights? Is he saying they're equal in intelligence? Is he an egalitarian? I mean, I've heard a sentence and it's perfectly clear by itself, but the thing is, we can't do anything with until we go back to the whole surrounding context. I'll give you another example, even clearer. Socrates is mortal. Now, I want you, as an exercise, to cut that off from any context. That is, you know the meaning. Well, I mean, you know that you're familiar with the word. Mortal. It's not as though I said Socrates is triddle. Socrates is mortal. Now, try to hold that in a vacuum, as a little isolated bit of cognition, unrelated to anything. And now try to decide, what does it mean and is it true? Well, right away my mind gives me the idea, well, I don't know if he's mortal or not. He's lived a lot longer than anybody else's ideas are still around, and that's really the substance of Socrates. He's eternal, his ideas are immortal. So Socrates is really immortal. Or, well, what about the atoms that make up Socrates? And these are things that occur to me out of context. They're still around somewhere, the subatomic particles. So theoretically, if I went around with a, you know, pin and collected them all and reconstructed them, Socrates is still here. Now, you see, I can go into any fantasy I want. Something made Socrates alive, and the thing that made him alive, since it's something, can't become nothing. So Socrates is somehow still around. His vitality is still here. Something doesn't become nothing. We just can't find it. Now, this is on the most absolutely elementary thing we were saying after we came home from his funeral. Nothing prevents you from doing anything. Because as soon as you cut it off from the context, it no longer has a relation to reality. How do you bring it back to reality? Only by saying, where did this idea come from that Socrates is mortal? Why do you believe it? What does it rest on? What are the other things we had to know in order to come to this conclusion? What is the context? And then if I go back to, well, it started, we observed certain things on the part of living organisms. Not only men, but animals and plants and so on. They go through a certain cycle, and then they disintegrate. And then we bury them, and they turn to dust. Now, if you define that context, you remind yourself of all the observations that fed into all men are mortal and all living beings are mortal. And that's the context. Then Socrates is mortal. Obviously, what you're making a statement relative to this whole framework of observation. And then anybody who switches on you and starts talking about his ideas in other people's minds or his atoms or his elements or whatever is changing the context completely. But when there's no context governing it, it's deuces one. It's just like taking a quotation out of context, or like Rawls takes a concept out of context, or like Chamberlain takes a proposal out of context. Without the governing context, it's anything goes. And that's why I say this sentence, the context is what sets the item's relationship to reality. And therefore, that tells you what it means and how to use it. And that is a very crucial formulation. And it means, therefore, that whenever you drop that context, whenever you treat something as just an isolated statement, you thereby have detached yourself from reality. You've turned it into one of these empty, amorphous ideas which you may think you understand perfectly well. But in fact, there's no longer anything guiding you. Because the only thing that guides you in the use of any statement or idea is everything you know that's relevant. And that is the context. If you drop that, it's like giving that idea to a baby and saying, run with it. I mean, then whatever his subconscious feeds him in any order, if there's anything to feed, is what takes over. So it's not just that all knowledge is relational, but this network of relations at any given moment is what sustains any one item. And that's the specific theory of knowledge as contextual, and thus the necessity to keep the relationships going at all times, the necessity of integration. I think I've said everything I want to. Give me one sec. Oh, I just want to show you on 190. In paragraph 3, that last big paragraph. To cut off a single field, this is in connection with compartmentalization, which is a form of context dropping. To cut off a single field, any field, from the rest of cognition, is to drop the vast context which makes that field possible and which anchors it to reality. With that, I'd like to ask you this question. I say any field there. Would that apply even to philosophy? Because after all, philosophy is supposed to be the foundation on which everything else rests. So does philosophy have to remain connected to the rest of cognition? Or could, since philosophy is this exalted science of fundamentals, couldn't we just have it without any context? Just just philosophy by itself, without science and history and economics and math, and we don't need all that. We're just, you know, in the exalted land of the queen of the sciences. Obviously, I don't believe that is possible for a minute. That's why I put any field. But if you see it in connection with philosophy, you see it in connection with everything, because this is the only one with even a shadow of a prayer of being before it and apart from everything else. Now, what would happen to philosophy if you treated it as its own compartment? Well, somebody said just what has happened to it, but yeah.
You have cut it off from existence.
Yes, exactly. You've cut it off from existence. How would you, just to take as a simple example, how would you ever reach the primacy of existence? You say, I can't be bothered having specialized experiences of chemical existence or physical existence or mental existence and so on. That's for the special scientist. I'm only concerned with existence as such. Well, where do you find it? This is why children can't philosophize. Only adults can. You have to acquire a wealth of knowledge in a breadth of fields before you can sit back and say, what are the principles true of everything? First, there have to be the things that make the everything. And then you can sit back and say, well, now, no matter what the subject matter, it's got to have cause and effect. But you have to first meet millions of concrete causes and concrete fields. And the same is true for every metaphysical and certainly for every epistemological principle. Imagine trying to formulate principles of epistemology while having no knowledge, only the study of knowledge. You first have to have tremendous knowledge in all kinds of fields and then try to grasp what's the common denominator. This is why, to jump, Ayn Rand's interest was philosophy, but she majored in history. Now, she did not take the attitude, well, who cares what people did? I'm concerned with what they should do. I asked her about that once, and she said, how am I going to say what they should do if I don't know what has actually happened from different ways that they have behaved? First, I have to see what they have done, and what did it lead to? And then I have some factual basis to see, this course leads to this result, and this leads to that result. Now I can start to think, what is it about the nature of man that would explain these? And I'm led to a certain view of how he properly should behave. But if I'm clean of any other data, I'm just going to philosophize, a rational being, how should he act? And that's all I got. Where am I going to go from there? Well, he should reason. About what? Well, I mean, it becomes void of any content, you see. It's empty. So this applies as much to philosophy as to any other subject. Knowledge is a whole. Any part dies the minute it's cut off from the rest. This doesn't mean you have to be a universal scholar, but it means you have to be in principle open to anything relevant to what you're interested in, if and when it comes along and it's within your context. And if you are that, then we'll go to the very last line in 192. You'll find that the more you learn, the more you know, the clearer you are, even about the old things that you knew, the better off you are. And this, I think, is the key to why Ayn Rand was not embattled. She didn't feel under siege from reality the way some objectivists do. That is, the feeling that they're on the defensive and any new piece of information might threaten or upset the conclusions they already have. If you feel that, it means that you're not using the right method. Properly speaking, your knowledge should be integrated so that you're wide open and eager to hear something new, if you think it's relevant and comes from a sensible, not an absurd source. You shouldn't feel threatened if someone says to you, there's a fact that doesn't cohere with your conclusion. Instead of the reaction being, oh no, the reaction should be, I mean, if it's a person you respect or you have reason to even pursue it, go ahead, let's hear. Ayn Rand was always eager, if she respected the person and the context, to hear what it is. But the argument, her reasoning being, if this integrates, I'll learn that much more. If it doesn't, I'll have discovered an error. So there's every incentive in the world to incorporate new material, and in that sense to be, quote, open-minded, remembering that that is perfectly compatible with being an absolutist. And the key to reconciling them is knowledge is contextual. Continue next time. Thank you.